been really hard for people in Alaska's sex industry to have any voice at all in the laws that affect them.
An effort to lobby lawmakers in Juneau on behalf of sex workers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 2nd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a swarm of earthquakes puzzles scientists and residents in the Pribilofs.
For me, honestly, it scares me because it's very unusual for St. George to be an earthquake.
Tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Republican leaders expect that the legislature will go ahead with a special session in October to consider a natural gas policy. Senate Rules Chair Charlie Huggins, a Wasilla Republican, says the legislature needs to take up tax legislation in order to keep up with scheduled development of a North Slope gas line.
We know that the governor has said that he wants to maintain or accelerate that timeline. We agree on that, and hence we have targeted October as a date for a special session to address any issues that might be involved.
House leadership is committed to keeping with the timeline as well. The project includes a liquefaction plant and a pipeline that would extend from the North Slope to Nikiski to transport the gas reserves to market. Estimates put the cost between $45 and $65 billion. Every legislative session, different interest groups will hire lobbyists to influence legislation that affects them. But what happens if you're already on the wrong side of the law? APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that a sex worker group is trying to raise money to send one of their own to Juneau.
Smartwatches, movies, even potato salad. All these things have found success with crowdfunding. Now, Tara Burns wants to see if internet users will pay for her to travel to Juneau and advocate on behalf of sex workers.
It's been really hard for people in Alaska's sex industry to have any voice at all in the laws that affect them because of stigma and criminalization.
Burns is 33 years old. She's a graduate student who studies the sex industry, and she's worked in it in the past. She's also affiliated with a sex worker group called Community United for Safety and Protection, which opposes human trafficking laws that were put on the books in 2012. The laws upped the penalties for coercing people into the sex industry, and they changed the statute so victims would not be referred to as prostitutes. But Burns thinks they have not worked as promised. Of the 7 people convicted of trafficking since the laws were put on the books, she says half were prostitutes themselves.
Most of the people that they have been charging have been, you know, women who have been working together in the industry.
Burns thinks the law should be amended so those who work in the sex industry of their own volition are not treated as traffickers and are not entrapped by police officers. 3 weeks ago, Burns launched a crowdfunding campaign through the website Tilt. It's like Kickstarter, but for causes. The goal is to raise $1,500 to pay for Burns to live out of a camper in Juneau for a month. So far, the crowdfunding campaign is only at the halfway mark, with just $800 raised. Burns says there weren't too many other funding options. She notes sex workers can't act like a union where they collect dues to pay for lobbying on issues that affect them.
I would love to be able to have that discussion, but it would be considered under the law sex trafficking in Alaska.
And she's volunteering because the group cannot afford a professional lobbyist. The Alaska Public Offices Commission does not have much experience with advocates supported by crowdfunding. But they think Burns will have to register with them as a representational lobbyist, since only her expenses are being covered. Even if the campaign stalls and those expenses are not fully covered, Burns has decided to come to the Capitol. So far, only one bill dealing with sex trafficking has been introduced, and it would allow victims of sex trafficking to use that as a defense if they are charged with prostitution crimes. Burns is opposing it because she thinks it splits members of the sex industry into victims and traffickers, while leaving voluntary participants in a difficult position. But bill sponsor Berta Gardner, an Anchorage Democrat and the Senate's minority leader, does not see the conflict.
My bill does not affect sex workers. It affects victims of sex trafficking. It doesn't touch sex workers who are voluntary sex workers in any way, shape, or form.
Gardner introduced the bill last year, and it passed the Senate unanimously before stalling in the House. Because the bill has not been controversial, Gardner is not sure that Burns' lobbying effort will be productive.
You know, she's well-intentioned and might very well be right about some of the things she's saying. But we deal with the reality here of what it takes to pass legislation. And you can have a great big earth-shaking proposal, or you can bite off one little piece that won't draw any opposition from any quarter and try to get that through.
But Gardner does sympathize with the difficulty that people affected by sex trafficking legislation, especially those who are victims, have in being heard by the legislature.
We got calls from people, but by and large, they were too frightened to speak on the record.
Burns plans to testify on the bill should it get a hearing. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
After Shell's troubled 2012 drilling season in the far north, the Interior Department began working on the Arctic-specific standards for offshore drilling. But those new standards aren't done yet. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says they won't be in place to guide Shell's planned return to the Chukchi Sea this year.
As Shell indicated just recently that they were going to go forward with their exploration plans this summer, we will be holding them to the standards that we have held them to before, with upgrades and proof that they can do what they say they do before they're allowed to go up there.
The standards are expected to require things like well containment systems and rigs on hand to drill relief wells and also limit the season. Jewell spoke to reporters in a press call on Monday primarily about the president's budget for her department. The five-year budget has nothing to bolster Alaska's hopes of winning federal offshore revenues. In fact, Jewell says the administration is trying to undo offshore revenue sharing for Louisiana, Texas, and neighboring states.
Outer Continental Shelf is owned by all Americans. So there is a small portion of the Gulf where there is revenue sharing proposed for certain Gulf states. We believe that needs to be reexamined to look at what is a fair return to the taxpayers across the whole United States.
The Interior Department budget includes full support costs for Alaska Native health care contracts. It also has more than $1 million for 3D mapping of Alaska and nearly $3 million to clean up the Red Devil Mine on the Kuskokwim River. The president's budget is essentially a request because spending decisions are up to Congress. The Pribilof Islands aren't usually prone to shaking, but more than a dozen earthquakes have been recorded in between St. Paul and St. George in the last few days. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more on what's causing this seismic swarm.
The Pribilofs sit in the middle of the Bering Sea, past the subduction zone that causes frequent earthquakes along the Aleutian Chain. State seismologist Michael West says the Pribilofs have always been pretty quiet until now.
So most of what we know about whatever fault it is that's active is coming from the earthquakes that we've actually seen in the past couple of days.
14 earthquakes, mostly around magnitude 4, have occurred since Friday. They're shallow, which suggests the source is somewhere in the Earth's crust.
There's some tension in the Earth that is a pulling apart as opposed to a pushing together. But they also have a lot of side-to-side motion. They're messy, is the short answer.
The earthquakes haven't caused any damage on St. Paul or St. George, where Jennifer Merkuliev works as a community health aide. She helped conduct a headcount and make sure all 68 residents on St. George could be ready to evacuate. That hasn't been necessary. And Merkuliev says some of her neighbors seem to be getting used to the trembling.
By the time it got to like the eighth one, people were saying, oh, I'm just going to go with it.
But for me, honestly, it scares me because I'm just, it's very unusual for St. George to get an earthquake. Since I've been here, I've never seen an earthquake on St. George ever.
It's been more than 20 years since the island saw a significant quake. A magnitude 6.7 struck north of St. George in 1991, sending a small tsunami across the Bering Sea. The National Tsunami Warning Center is prepared to issue an alert for Unalaska and Sandpoint, but only if the earthquakes get stronger, above a magnitude 7. Science officer Paul Huang says that rule is based on the configuration of the seabed around the Pribilofs.
This is a special region in Alaska. It's unlike the front part of the Aleutians. The water shadow, so we have a different criteria.
Huang and other scientists say there's no evidence to suggest the earthquakes will become more severe. But at this point, they also don't have any clues about how long it will take for the shaking to stop. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Lance Mackey describes his dogs as he prepares his team for the Yukon Quest.
You know, mine are very personable, very opinionated. They always have something to say, it seems like.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Tenaya Child Development Center at the University of Alaska last week received notice from the university that the center will need to find a new location. The decision has left many parents frustrated, but the two sides are still in discussions to see if a new agreement can be reached. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Though Tenaya has been housed on the university campus for decades, it operates as an independent nonprofit organization. Scott Hamill is an assistant professor at the university and the president of the Tenaya Board of Directors. He says the university sent Tenaya a letter last week notifying them that their long-standing agreement would be terminated.
It's from 1989, and that agreement basically states that Tenaya will provide services and preference to students and faculty and staff in return for the space that it now occupies and the utilities.
In the letter, Hamill says the university cited space constraints and liability issues as reasons for the decision. The program can accommodate around 60 children between 18 months and 5 years old. Hamill says about 90% of those enrolled are the children of university students, staff, and faculty, many of whom were waitlisted for 1 to 2 years. Mark Schulman's oldest son is in first grade, but was enrolled in Tenaya when he was younger. And Schulman says the benefits of the program have been easy to see.
He actually had some issues with speech, and it helped him get an early notice so we can get him extra support when he was 2 or 3 and speaking. And now getting that help and continuing that help with the state and with them, it helped him to progress into, you know, he's reading now and he's doing a lot better with speech. But that extra help, really, they need a development.
Schulman has another son who is currently enrolled in Tenaya and hopes his youngest can begin attending this summer. Discussions are still ongoing between Tenaya and the university, but Hamill says the center is looking for a new location if a new agreement doesn't come to fruition. But finding a new facility to suit Tenaya's needs could be problematic. It costs approximately $900 per month for a child to attend Tenaya. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska Regional Hospital is planning to open a health care clinic in Mountain View by the end of the year. There aren't any primary care services in the neighborhood currently. That's forcing residents to use Alaska Regional's emergency room for routine care, according to Medicaid data from the State Department of Health and Social Services. That costs the hospital in uncompensated care, and it costs the state in unnecessary Medicaid payments. When Julie Taylor became CEO of Alaska Regional a year ago, the board was already talking about opening a Mountain View clinic. Taylor says it was immediately obvious to her that there was a need.
If we're looking at how we're going to be using healthcare dollars effectively, finding ways to reach populations, to treat them closer to home at the right level of care is a better use of those funds.
Neighborhood residents have been asking for better access to primary care for years. In 2002, the Anchorage Community Land Trust hosted a summit where the need for local health services was a clear priority. Kirk Rose is executive director of the Land Trust. He says Alaska Regional has responded in a big way and residents are thrilled.
We've been working on it for, you know, it's kind of a, patience is a virtue, good things come to those who wait, but we've been very tough and staunch about fighting for a health presence in the neighborhood. So we're hoping that this is a really nice win and that, you know, it enhances quality of life for the people who live here.
Taylor says the clinic will be large enough to offer about 3,000 patient visits a year. Aaron's Law is back in the legislature. If passed, the bill would require school districts statewide to provide age-appropriate K-12 sexual abuse education. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Last session, Representative Garen Tarr, a Democrat from Anchorage, introduced Aaron's Law, which died in the House Finance Committee. This time around, Tarr filed the same version she introduced last year before the session even started, but for the same reasons.
The idea here is by having this education, students know how to speak up if they have experienced sexual assault or sexual violence, if someone has, you know, done something to them that shouldn't have been done. It's about giving students that voice and giving them the language to speak up so they are empowered and can be a part of stopping this from happening in Alaska.
Alaska has some of the highest rates of child sex abuse in the country. There were nearly 2,700 sexual abuse cases involving children reported to the State Office of Children's Services in 2014. The law is named after 29-year-old Erin Marin from Illinois, who was sexually abused as a child and has made it her goal to pass the law in all 50 states. Last year, she testified before the legislature about the law, which Tarr says had broad bipartisan support.
I'm looking forward to that same level of support this year. There were several different suggestions as to what happened. It got lost at the end of session. Maybe there was some partisan decision-making involved. I was a freshman member of the Democratic minority. Maybe we ran out of time.
This year, Republican representative and majority leader Charisse Millett has introduced another version. She says she wants to hear from local Alaskans throughout the process.
I would like to have a face, folks talking about this bill that are from Alaska that have the Alaskan story that they can tell, because I think it's important for folks in Alaska to hear from Alaskans. And it's important that Alaskans take ownership that there is a problem and then an ownership that they want to solve the problems.
Bethel Democratic Representative Bob Herron supports the bill. He says all too often he sees problems with how sexual abuse is handled in schools, especially in his district.
They just call OCS and then someone else comes in. And that OCS person, though they are hardworking people, they're not around the children as much as a teacher is. And so I think it's important that teachers, school administrators are taught the warning signs, and then maybe we can collectively, society can get involved earlier rather than later when a child is being harmed.
Or prevent it altogether, says Herron. He points out that there was recently a large out-of-court settlement in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta's Upete School District over a teacher accused of molesting girls in Tuliksak.
Of course, it's well chronicled that recently in one of the schools and in one of the villages in the Delta, we had a school employee that was involved in abusing these young people. So we got to talk about it. Just communication is better.
The bill does not have a fiscal note attached. However, legislators say it could cost districts to train staff. Members of the House majority say bills that cost money will get extra scrutiny this session as the state faces a multi-billion dollar budget deficit due to falling oil prices. Last year, Tarr said the Alaska Children's Trust, the Rasmussen Foundation, and the Mat-Su Health Foundation had all expressed support for the bill. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Poor design led to last summer's catastrophic failure of a British Columbia mine tailings pond. That's the conclusion of an investigation ordered by provincial officials and released on Friday. Mine critics in Southeast Alaska say the report illustrates their concerns about Canadian mines in watersheds that drain into the Inside Passage. Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The engineering report identifies the likely cause of August 4th's dam failure at Mount Polly, an open-pit copper and gold mine in east-central British Columbia. A small part of the dam collapsed, and millions of gallons of silty water poured through, widening the gap and sending a huge amount of water into nearby creeks and lakes. The report says the breach was caused by the failure of the dam's foundation. It says too much weight was put on an underground layer of glacial sand and gravel that developers and inspectors didn't know about. Sitka Mayor Mim McConnell says the report gives credence to concerns voiced by Southeast Alaska leaders.
We need to protect our waters, and what they do upstream does affect us. It could have a huge impact if there were another spill. And the United States has to have a say on what happens in Canada on this particular issue.
The report recommends more stringent standards for tailing pond design, as well as better government inspections. Both could affect other mines in the province, including projects under development near waterways that flow through Alaska. Karina Brino is president of the Mining Association of British Columbia. She says the report could speed rather than slow permits needed for new development.
Decisions have been put on hold because we were waiting for this report. So that clarity from government and from the regulators will be helpful to the industry.
In my mind, and in the minds of many other Alaskans, is whether it will be that business as usual, will that be changed fast enough?
Juneau's Heather Hardcastle is a gillnetter and co-owner of Taku River Reds, which catches and markets salmon. She doubts serious changes will happen because of the report, since the provincial government is doing all it can to support mine development.
That certainly is a concern about the speed at which projects in BC for the last 5-8 years have been evaluated, permitted, developed, constructed, and Mount Polly does raise red flags about the quality and the frequency of inspections.
Mount Polly does not drain into any Alaska watersheds, but its owner, Imperial Metals, is about to open the Red Chris mine near the Stikine River, which enters the ocean near Wrangell and Petersburg. Another mine under exploration is the KSM, which will operate near two watersheds that drain into the Pacific within 50 miles of Ketchikan. And there's an attempt to reopen the Tulsiqua Chief, a mine on a tributary of the Taku River near Juneau.
There's nothing that the Canadian government or their environmental people over there can say to us that would make us feel better.
Ketchikan's Rob Sanderson Jr. co-chairs the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Work Group. He's concerned about impacts on subsistence and commercial fishing.
I think they're, you know, again, going back to that Band-Aid approach. I don't think that's going to hold.
Mine critics are lobbying the U.S. State Department to put transboundary mines before a panel that resolves cross-border conflicts. So far, there's been no action. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Over the weekend, veterinarians looked over the sled dogs that will run the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race in both Fairbanks and Whitehorse. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, they wanted to make sure the dogs are healthy, well-fed, and ready to race on the 1,000-mile trail.
Inside a large warehouse, veterinarian Nina Hansen checks the paws and teeth and listens to the heartbeats
of sled dogs.
I look at their eyes, make sure their eyes are bright and clear. I look at their mucous membranes. You can get a good idea of how well hydrated a dog is by looking at the color of their mucous membranes. Look at their teeth. They should have, you know, clean teeth that are in good shape. If a dog has a lot of dental disease, just like in people, that can lead to problems in the rest of the body. And then I generally will assess body condition after that, and I just run my hands along their spine, feel their ribs, feel their muscles in general.
A small reddish-brown dog stands nearby. This dog doesn't have a radio frequency microchip, so Hansen reaches for a needle and inserts one in the skin just behind the dog's ear.
So it's about the size of a grain of rice. It's a passive identification. When you run the scanner over it, it'll come up with a unique number that only this dog has. So we use this to identify them.
This is Hansen's first year as the Yukon Quest head veterinarian, but she's worked on the race for the last six. For the most part, these dogs are calm, alert, and many of them wag their tails. Hansen isn't surprised.
When I was in small animal practice, which I did for 3 years, there was not a day that went by that a dog didn't try to bite me. but I have been working with sled dogs for going on 7 years now, and I have been bit one time by a sled dog, and I've looked at thousands and thousands of sled dogs. So sled dogs are very well socialized. They're great to work with. They're great with people. They're used to being handled. They're used to being around people.
A group of black and orange dogs surround us. They belong to four-time Yukon Quest champion Lance Mackey.
You know, mine are very personable, very opinionated. They always have something to say, it seems like, but
it seems like in describing your dogs, you're kind of describing yourself.
I've heard that more than once. You know, I think it you lead by example.
Mackey last ran the race in 2013, but he didn't finish that year. He says this year, only one of his dogs is a returning veteran. The others are young two-year-olds he hopes to develop over the coming years.
On that note, I want to race them like they're five-year-olds, you know, because I do have something I feel I want to prove, so to speak, because of my race season in the past several years.
And most of the mushers set to race are confident their teams will hold up on the 1,000-mile trail from Whitehorse. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race starts Saturday in Whitehorse, Yukon. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dacia Eaton in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.